Ambassador Princeton Lyman, thank you very much for this opportunity to speak to the Voice of America.
Thank you.
What's out there that you're living? When are you leaving?
Well, I've told the administration that I would wait until there's a selection of a successor and work through the transition, so we don't have a firm date.
When are they selecting a successor? Is
Well,
there...
that's not out of my hands.
Well, when you were appointed in March 31st, 2011, you were entrusted with ensuring that there is no conflict between North Sudan and South Sudan over Abyei. You were also entrusted with seeing that the CPA is fully implemented to the letter. And previously, you were an ambassador in South Africa during that transition from apartheid to democracy. How do you take your experience from South Africa and implemented in South Sudan, Sudan and South Sudan relations?
Well, there are, of course, a number of great differences. The situation in South Africa was an internal one. It was not splitting the country. But there were lessons there, lessons about statesmanship on the part of both President Mandela and then President F.W. de Klerk, certain principles that they reached in the course of the negotiations at one critical point, not to let spoilers get in the way. So there are some lessons there. But the situation in Sudan and South Sudan is different. 40 years of civil war, really, two civil wars, leaving a great deal of bitterness and suspicion and anger. And even though South Sudan became independent peacefully, all the issues that go to setting up a state-to-state relationship have been very slow in coming.
President Salva Kiir and President Omar Hassan al-Bashir have been battlefield commanders, and now they are entrusted with the responsibility of working out the diplomatic relations between the two for their economic reasons. They are responsible for creating a good image of their countries out there in the backdrop of the lot of fighting that's going on there. You have been interacting with these two leaders. Do you see them as leaders who are able, willing to deliver peace to their people?
I think that that neither country wants to go back to full-scale war. I think that's fairly clear. But I think in Sudan, there is a group of people who bear a great deal of suspicion towards South Sudan, and therefore do not trust them in terms of agreements, and prefer to take a harder line and a more demanding line than sometimes President Bashir has expressed at the summit. President Kiir, for his part, has pledged himself to a peaceful agreement, but he has people in his government who feel that these agreements haven't produced anything, and therefore they are questioning whether the concessions or agreements are worthwhile. So for the two presidents, while they have come together and kept the process going, both of them have people inside who are not fully confident about this whole process. And that has slowed it up and made it very difficult to move forward.
And what is the way forward in a situation
well,
like
I
that?
Well, I think the way forward is that the two countries have to realize where their interests are. For example, there are people in the government of Sudan who feel that by holding up on the oil agreement, not letting it go forward, and by introducing new additional demands about security, that they somehow can gain more from South Sudan. I think it's a mistake. What they're doing is producing more disillusionment in South Sudan than any of these agreements will ever be implemented. So instead of getting more cooperation, they're in danger of getting less. The same is true on Abyei. In South Sudan, I think there has to be a recognition that there are big issues in state building. And the focus on Sudan as the source of many of or most of their problems is diverting them to some extent from undertaking the issues they have to deal with at home. So I think both sides have to think very carefully about how do you have a relationship with a country you don't necessarily like very much, but you have to have that relationship for your own security and economic benefit.
Yeah, yes, sticking to the issues of the agreement, The agreement that was signed recently in Addis Ababa, the cooperative agreement, how is it different from any other agreement that was signed there previously, given the fact that Sudan and South Sudan are on record for not implementing what they normally sign? Are we seeing these countries going back to war again? Are we seeing lack of implementation?
Well, this is exactly the challenge. They signed not only the cooperative agreement, but a total of 9 agreements, all the kinds of agreements you would expect the two states side by side should have, on borders, on trade, on oil, on security, etc. None of them have been implemented nearly 4 months later. And that goes to this issue I raised about people who are in each government saying, why should we do this? We're not getting enough from them. And the result is you get nothing from them. And I think the strategy is wrong on the part of those people who are making additional demands rather than moving forward on what they've signed. I don't think the two want to go back to war. I don't think they will go back to full-scale war. But the danger of conflicts breaking out on the border, clashes, cross-border raids, I think this is very great. And they have in front of them an agreement on demilitarizing the border, which I think is in the interest of both countries in a major way. And why Khartoum doesn't move on that more rapidly is something I don't quite understand.
Some critics of the administration of President Obama and of you as the special envoy say you are handling Khartoum with the kid's gloves. Given the issues in Sudan, for instance, President Omar Hassan al-Bashir is an indicted president wanted by the International Criminal Court, and the war in Darfur and the issues in Blue Nile. How do you react to that?
Well, I think there are people in Khartoum who would not say we're handling them with kid gloves. Look, the fact is that we don't deal directly with President Bashir because of the indictment. We have many sanctions on Sudan, they are still on the list of state sponsors of terrorism. So I think many in Khartoum would say to you, no, not at all handling them with kid gloves. And we have been very concerned about human rights issues. They've recently closed down several civil society organizations. There have been other human rights violations, arrests, etc., detainees. So we recognize all of that. And yet, at the same time, if you're going to have peace between two countries, you have to have peace between two governments working together. And that's in the interest of the Sudanese people, and it's in the interest of both countries. So with all those problems that we have with Sudan, we still support their efforts and South Sudan's efforts to get peace and development for both countries.
And what are the skills necessary to mediate between two parties that don't trust each other? For instance, the South Sudan situation. What have you learned during your 2 years conducting shuttle diplomacy between Khartoum and Juba?
Well, I think for people like President Mbeki and others, my colleagues who are envoys and myself, you do have to build up a feeling that you're being fair and objective on the issues. We may have many problems with Sudan, as you've talked about, but when it comes to working on issues of border security, on oil, on other things, we have tried to be fair and objective and balanced and promote agreements that serve both sides. And if you can do that, and if you're recognized as doing that, then you can be helpful. We've tried very hard to do that. For example, take the oil agreement. We argued for a long time that the only successful oil agreement would be one that did involve some transfer of resources from South Sudan to Sudan. It took a long time for that principle to be fully accepted and built into the agreement. But that now is an agreement that's of great benefit to Khartoum if they go forward with it. On the border, the arrangements that we've worked on with President Mbeki provide for both sides to have some assurances about support of proxies, one side or the other. So we don't always convince people that we're being objective and fair, but that's the essence of the job that we're trying to do.
The United Nations recently said that the situation in the Nuba Mountains and southern Blue Nile, Blue Nile State is getting from worse to what you would name it. And they're saying around 1 million people are at risk of starvation. Now, you have been talking to the Sudanese leaders and rebels of the SPLM North. What do you think should be done to break the stalemate and possibly give relief aid to people who have barely nothing to eat?
Well, this is one of the major, major crises that's still going on. And it's not only affecting all the people in the Nuba Mountains and Blue Nile, it's also making the relationship with Sudan and South Sudan much more difficult. There are two ways to get at the issue of Southern Kordofan and Blue Nile. The most important is to open up a political dialogue between the government and the SPLM to stop the fighting and to open up humanitarian access so that people are not going to starve. That proposition has been on the table. In principle, I find people on both sides agree that that needs to be done, but the political will to do it is not yet there. Second, by demilitarizing the border, Khartoum can get more assurances that support isn't flowing from the south to increasing the conflict. Those two steps should go side by side, not one before the other or vice versa. And yet we don't have that. Khartoum has to recognize, and I think many do, that it's basically a political internal problem. Now for the SPLM North, it's extremely important that they talk about their own commitment to a unified Sudan and a Sudan in which everyone has a place. Not so much of we're going to overthrow the government and take over, that kind of thing. That makes it harder to get to a political solution.
Of late, there are a lot of reports from Darfur fighting between the Sudan Liberational Front and then Sudan Armed Forces. And there are some talks of agreements being prepared in Doha. Other rebel factions are taking part in that. Do you see an end to the fighting in Darfur?
Well, unfortunately, the violence has picked up, particularly in northern Darfur and now the Jebel Mara area. It's not totally dissimilar from the problems of southern Kordofan and Blue Nile in that the fundamental issues of Sudan's governance, how it will be governed and how people in all parts of Sudan feel that they're a respected and fully sharing part of the country. So there, too, there has to be more done politically from Khartoum about the future of Sudan and how the diversity of the country and the various elements can play a big role. So it's not just Darfur, just South Kordofan and Blue Nile. It's the future of Sudan itself.
Yeah, is there one lesson that you as a diplomat with decades of experience will take away from your work as a special envoy?
Well, I think in this case, what's very important has been the role of the African Union. The African Union has really stepped forward to take on this set of issues. And the African Union Peace and Security Council set forth a roadmap last April, which has been very influential in bringing the parties this far. And they have to stay out in front. And then they can be backed up by the Security Council. And last June, you'll recall, Ambassador Rice was able to bring the Security Council into a unanimous vote in support of the African Union roadmap. That unity on the part of the international community is critical. Having the African Union stand together, the Security Council stand together, that way you can influence the two countries that the international community has a stake in what happens and they can't just ignore it.
And if do you know if, I'd ask you before, but do you know if President Obama plans naming a new special envoy to replace you?
Yes, the White House has said they will.
And if you would recommend, who would you recommend for that?
Oh, well, that's an internal matter.
And what advice would you give to the new special envoy?
Well, I think two things. I think you have to have an enormous amount of patience. Sometimes it gets very frustrating. You get disappointed. You think things are moving forward, and then there's a monkey wrench thrown into the works. But second, again, going back to what I said before, trying to convince each side that the things you're recommending are objective and fair, and that it is the interests of the United States for both countries to be at peace and to develop, that we do want a normal relationship with Sudan. And as these issues get resolved, we can move toward that.
What are you going to do next?
I'm still working on that.
Well, let's just, this is the last question here. Events happening in the sub-Saharan Africa, especially the Sahel, and in the backdrop of the revolution that was there in Libya, Al-Shabaab here in Somalia, and all these things affect South Sudan or the future of South Sudan. What are your thoughts on the developments in the Sahel region?
Well, I think this is a very serious challenge for Africa. The unrest in Mali, the introduction of new groups who are run far against Malian traditional culture and have imposed some terrible oppression in the north and represent a very radical element, contrary even to the traditional Tuareg demands in Mali. And I think the international community, again, with the strong African lead in ECOWAS, and now assisted by the French, have to respond to this. I think the loss of democracy in Mali was a great tragedy. This is one of the great success stories. And there has to be work to restore democracy there. But generally speaking, on the continent, there's been a lot of progress in Africa, a lot of progress economically, a lot of progress politically. Some of the fastest growing countries in the world are on the continent of Africa. I think we have to keep that perspective in mind. For South Sudan, once they can get past these issues, particularly getting their oil revenue back, they have to deal much more with building their state, because if they're not strong internally, they won't be able to deal with the problems around them.
Well, Ambassador Princeton Lyman, you're a busy man. I think we will end it up here. And thank you very much for this opportunity to speak to us.
It's been my pleasure, John.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.